So our topic today is top 10 reasons you are going to see us, you are going to have to see us in the future. And coming in at number 10 is,
oh, too far.
Okay. Coming in at number 10 is keeping it in the family.
So the number 10 reason you're going to have to see us in the future, well, of course we mean see us in our capacity as attorneys. You may have to see us for some other reasons, but that's personal. We'll talk about that offline. But basically what we're trying to say here, the number 10 reason is because, you know, for example, you think that doing business with family members or close friends means that nothing has to be in writing, right? So, you know, especially in, you know, minority communities and the Asian communities, a lot of times, you know, with this between brothers or cousins, we just think, hey, you know what? We just do this on a handshake. A word in a handshake is good. We don't need to draft material terms. So then they just start moving forward. Well, unfortunately, it'd be scary for us to really tell you how many times we see family members coming in, getting advice from us or seeking our opinion about what they should do because their brother or their cousin or sometimes even their parent, you know, did something to them in terms of one of the transactions, and now they're potentially seeking to get redressed from the courts. So, you know, and then, you know, we're always left thinking, well, did you write something down? And then, of course, we hear so often, they're like, no, it was my mom. Not saying that you would sue your mom, but, you know, just, you know, they're like, no, I didn't think I needed one. Well, you know, that's the problem, right? Because first and foremost is if you don't set down the material terms, over time, you're going to forget about what those terms were, right? So whether it's 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, if you're lucky, if that business activity still keeps going, you're not going to remember who was responsible for what. Or even worse, you're not going to remember, you know, what the profit split was going to be, how you're supposed to split liabilities. Like, let's say, you know, you have LLC, you have pass-through tax treatment, how are you going to split losses on your K-1s? And that can lead to a whole host of issues, right? Maybe you need further contributions. Well, how much does each person need to contribute? So, I mean, we always say, you know, if you put something in writing between family members, it's not that, you know, you're basically already seeing the negative consequences of doing business with your family member. No, no, it's actually meant to help you, just to clarify the responsibilities of the parties, right? It's to prevent conflict in the future, right? It's not, you know, because obviously people don't want to bring that issue up when they're dealing with their families. It's kind of like a prenup, right? No one wants to talk about a prenup because you're already talking about something negative in the beginning of something that's supposed to be beautiful and conflict-free. But, you know, this is different than a prenup, right? The contract is really, you should see it from a different perspective. It's a means of making sure everyone understands their responsibilities, their liabilities, and what they're ultimately going to gain from the enterprise.
I think a good example of that is that we have a case, we had a case before where two sisters, and one of the sisters' husband died, basically, and then the other sister's husband basically took over the business, tried to help the sister-in-law out to continue the business, which was freight forwarding. And the understanding wasn't clearly defined how his involvement was going to, because he was already in the freight forwarding business. And he brought in some of his customers, some of his contacts. You know, he made sure the sister-in-law's freight forwarding business was continuing and flourishing. And he had an expectation that he will have some kind of a permanent compensation or position at her company as well, because he brought in his business and contact as well. But her understanding was different. Her understanding was that, you know, because they're family, she just expected him to help out for, you know, a couple of months. And then, you know, and when she was up on her feet and that she could continue to manage and do, you know, things in her own way. And there was a dispute. And those are the prime example of things that could happen. The most uncomfortable things are the ones that you should actually discuss and define, because it will come about at the end, and there will become an argument. And now, if you think about it, it ended up in litigation. Now two sisters are not seeing each other, which is, you know, not is the worst thing possible, right? Because It's not because of two sisters got into a fight. It's because of, you know, a relationship between her husband and the other sister, you know. So that's one of the examples I could give you.
All right, we'll move on.
All right. Next slide.
Roll it. And just for note.
Coming in number 9 is you blame the other Asian driver.
And before we start or continue on, I just want to note we're not affiliated with, endorsed by, sponsored by David Letterman or Tonight Show. We're just doing it because it's a form that people seem to enjoy. All right, so basically what this is that, you know, obviously our office is in Midtown. So we're right in Koreatown pretty much. And, you know, we always hear people are like, oh, Asian drivers are the worst, especially in that area. I don't know if that's true. Hopefully I don't lend to that, you know, but this is actually not true. So the number one reason for car accidents is distracted driving. Number 2 is speeding. I think those two are pretty obvious. And then number 3 is, DUI, driving under the influence. So we do have a criminal practice as well. DUIs are very much our most typical kinds of cases from our existing business clients, right? Why? Because it's business, you know, people, you're out there networking and going to events, and a lot of times they have bars. Sometimes if it's a good event, it'll be open bar, right? So, and then people have a couple of drinks, they feel fine, they get in the car, drive, next thing you know, they get pulled over for a myriad of reasons, whatever, taillights out, they're driving too fast, whatever. Next thing you know, they got a DUI, and they're coming to us, they're asking about what's going on, and it turns out that it's going to seriously not only affect their personal life, but potentially affect their business, right? So even for first offense, you're looking at potential suspension of your license, which obviously it's going to be difficult to operate your business, go to your work without being able to drive. If you're a professional, you have a medical license, you're going to have to report that as an arrest, and that can affect your professional license. So some professional licenses are affected more than others, medical licenses especially. If you're a lawyer, not so much, because so many attorneys drink. We have to. If you came to our office, you'd see why. But basically, I mean, there's some things that people don't know. In California, obviously, 0.08, most people know, that's a statutory limit. So if you blow 0.08 or above, you're per se drunk. That's it, DUI, right? But that's not the only way you can get a DUI, right? In California, if you blow below 0.08, the officer can still give you a field sobriety test, and based upon his own observations of you, he can determine that you're driving impaired. He can still get a DUI based on the officer's observations. So he won't have a breathalyzer evidence, but he will be able to go in there and testify as to his own observations of your ability to drive. So, you know, and that's kind of scary if you look at, you know, what it takes to get a 0.08, right? I believe the studies keep changing, but I believe it was like one drink, which is like one beer, one glass of wine, or one shot. For like a 180-pound individual, that already potentially make you 0.08. It's all right, I like that song. So, I mean, even that can give you a 0.08, and it depends on a lot of factors. Sometimes genetics play into effect, too. So if you're a woman, obviously, if you're under 180 pounds, one drink, that's all it takes. And the next thing you know, you're looking at $5,000 to $10,000 in fines and legal fees just to get yourself out of that situation. And that's going to impact your business. It's going to impact you personally, but it's also potentially going to impact your business. So, you know, obviously, our suggestion is if you're going to drink, have a plan, right? So if you're at an event and you're going to drink, have a designated driver, call a taxi, right? If you look at legal type events, symposiums, that's like you'll see tremendous amounts of taxis and whatnot. They drink, they're calling taxis because they know the repercussions of getting caught in that DUI.
I have a friend who I'm embarrassed to say, but he got 3 DUIs in California. And he had to have a breathalyzer attached to his car to start his car. He's only allowed to drive his car to go to work, nowhere else. And because of that, he moved to New York. He got a job in New York because he couldn't drive. Because if you can't drive in California, you can't go anywhere. You know, so that's a prime example of what could happen, basically. So, next one, please. Number eight is, I have a secret.
So the number eight reason why you're going to have to come see us in the future is, for example, you start talking about your business plans, your business ideas, your brand new product that you're holding so close to your chest, you start talking about it with other people. Time goes by, all of a sudden, you see your business idea, your product out in the market. Someone beat you to the market with your own product. Now you're coming to us, you're saying, what can I do? You know, I want to sue this guy. This guy stole my idea. We're going to ask, well, you know what? Did you guys have something in writing? Before you talk to that person, did you get an NDA, non-disclosure agreement, NDC, non-disclosure, non-circumvent? A lot of times, especially in the minority community, be like, no, I was just talking to this guy. He was my cousin's friend. He was my uncle's business partner, former business partner. And I talk to a whole bunch of people. I can't use an NDA all the time. Well, that's one of the problems, right? Because sometimes our habits are not necessarily good habits, right? Yes, it's kind of annoying if you have this business idea and, you know, you want to talk to people about it. Every single time before you talk, you're saying, hey, you know what? Can you sign this non-disclosure agreement? I mean, it could get really, you know, just laborious. And then people just tend to stop doing it. Like, okay, you're just beaten down. Like, all right, forget it. I'll just talk to you. But what happens is that's going to lead to potentially negative consequences, right? And if we're trying to mitigate against that, then I would say we got to change our habits, right? So just make it habitual to ask people to enter into NDAs, right, or non-circumvents before you start. That way, you will have some redress potentially if they go ahead behind your back and they start your business idea without you, without your approval, and they bring the product to the market before you. Right? And I mean, for nothing else too, having that kind of agreement is like, it's just a reminder for them. You know, it seems like when people sign something, when they execute something, it does something to them, right? It's like it reinforces in their mind, like, oh, okay, this is this guy's idea, and I can't steal it from him or her, right? It actually will prevent you potentially from having this kind of conflict because they'll remember that they signed some document and they can't go down that road.
Another way of protecting your ideas are obviously either copywriting it, patenting it, or trademark it. And a lot of things are not copyrightable, you know, patentable, or trademarkable, but you know, there are things that you could do. So any kind of intellectual property you consider as your own idea and has some intricacy and has uniqueness, you know, you could get it basically protected. And you know, you should consult an attorney to do that before you talk to other people. And also, if you consider something as a trade secret that's not a you know, legally protectable by getting a patent or copyright, then you know, you should not talk about it with the people that you're not sure, you know, that you could trust. You know, you can talk about the idea of what business it is, but intricacy, actual trade secret, don't talk about it unless you get an NDA.
You probably shouldn't trust anyone, right? Especially if it's a good idea, and hopefully if it's your idea, you think it's good. So I mean, the other thing we should talk about is like statute of frauds, because a lot of times now people will say, oh, you know what? Before I share this with you, you gotta promise me you won't share it with anybody else. Like, okay. Well, there's certain agreements that are not enforceable as an oral contract, right? So there's something called statute of frauds. Basically comes into play, and basically it requires, let's say, agreements that are not fully performable within 1 year to be in writing. So an oral agreement to say, hey, don't share my, you know, business idea that I'm sharing with you now, that's arguably not performable in 1 year, right? So whether or not that oral promise not to share your secrets is actually going to be something you can force later on as an oral contract, that's seriously in question. And you know, if you're going to go down the road of mitigating your potential liabilities, right, That's not what you want. You want something more than an oral agreement not to share your business idea. Right? So NDA, something really simple you can put together. Any attorney can help you in doing something like that. And you know, a lot of time businesses, once they do enough of them, you can pretty much customize it for your own uses, right? Swapping out names. It's the same ideas that you're sharing.
All right, next one. Number 7 is, my lucky number is 1099. And Jimmy stole our thunder. I mean, you know, he covered pretty much everything we're going to talk about under the subject, you know, but there are a few things that we wanted to add.
Yeah, I mean, we also have a lot of, you know, cases, obviously, well, on our end, most of the time it's the employers coming to us and basically saying, hey, you know, one of my former employees or my former contractors is now, you know, suing me, or they initiated a complaint to the labor commissioner, right, basically stating that I improperly characterized him as an independent contractor when he was really an employee. Right, so that happens, but also what happens is sometimes you have an employee that, you know, and businesses like to do this to save on, you know, on overtime. They'll characterize them as some kind of executive, like an manager, right, to try to exempt that person from overtime pay. And then they forget that there's actually requirements before you can actually fit somebody into that executive exemption. So like one of them, and each, it depending on what industry you're in, there's different IWC orders that apply to your particular business. But, you know, for example, there's some of them that require a manager be paid 2 times the minimum wage, right? So a lot of people end up making the mistake. They just say, okay, you're a manager then. I hire you, you're an employee, you're a manager. So now you got to work, you know, a god-awful 16 hours a day, and I'm only going to pay you for 1 day's rate. And then that person eventually, you know, whether they're disgruntled, as Jimmy had said, or they find out from a friend that, you know what, that's wrong, and then they seek redress from a plaintiff side labor attorney. Well, I'll stop right there for a second. For you businesses, plaintiff side labor attorneys are your worst enemies, right? Those guys will attack you any which way. They'll write correspondence to you once they have, you know, one of your former employees to sink their hooks into you. They'll lie to you in their letters. They'll trick you. They'll, you know, impliedly threaten your business. They use all these tactics to coerce a settlement from you. They are definitely, in my opinion, they can be the sharks of the legal world, especially on the plaintiff's bar. So, like Jimmy was saying, I'll just go along, basically ride his tail coach. You need to ensure that what you're doing with your employees in terms of characterization of the type of employee or independent contractor they are, you need to do that correctly. You need to ensure you know you have an accurate tracking system. Make sure you're taking meal breaks, you know, rest periods, all of that stuff, because you know, there's some really bad examples of people, businesses getting hit, not by one lawsuit, over and over and over again by the same plaintiff's attorney.
Another example that I have is this pretty famous bakery that opened up in Koreatown, and this employer, the bakery was sued 7 times in a row. 7 different times in a row by a same employment plaintiff's attorney, you know, and every single time, I mean, from what I know of, she didn't do anything wrong, but she just didn't keep a time clock. So that one of the employees got a smart idea of saying that I work overtime, and she can't prove that I didn't work overtime because she doesn't have the time clock, you know, because you're supposed to manage time clock if you're paying an hourly employee. And then she settled one case. Then next thing you know, the other employee quits, and then she filed a claim, and then 7 times, you know, that bakery closed down. You know, and those things could happen if you don't keep a proper record of your employees.
Be careful. Be careful of the plaintiff's bar businesses. You don't want them breathing down your neck, right? That first letter that comes in to your business from that plaintiff side attorney, potentially, and for a lot of businesses, and we've seen this happen, that was the first step to them actually closing down their business, filing bankruptcy. So, you know, I would say, you know what, take a little bit of time, spend a little bit of money, just to ensure that you have the processes in place to maintain your employees and under the law, right? And that's all I'll say about that. Right. Next.
Next slide.
Drum roll.
Number six is ABCDEFG Corp. Now I know my LLC.
I had nothing to do with writing these titles, number one. I just wanted to tell you
that.
So, I mean, basically what we're trying to say here is that, you know, we have people who just come in. They have no idea why, but they have a C Corp, right? So they have that Inc., the incorporated, or the corp, or the corporation title at the end of their entity name, right? So they're running a traditional C Corp. And they'll come in, and now they're saying, you know what? I don't really like that form of a corporation. I'm taking a double tax hit, right? They're getting taxed at the corporate level. Then when they get the dividends or distribution from the corporation, they're taking another hit on their personal taxes as part of their income. So now they want to convert the C Corp to an LLC. And so we say, okay, yeah, I mean, you can do it. So now we're kind of changing things back around for them, and they got to change certain corporate governance issues. I mean, I'm going to keep this really short and sweet just because, you know, I want to address this, especially when we're talking about the entrepreneurs, the small businesses. In reality, an LLC will fit your needs just fine, right? Why do you have an LLC? Why do you have a corporation? Right? It's because you want that shield. You want something to stand in between the way of the business's liabilities and your personal assets, right? That's why you create an entity. Is it that important to create a C Corp versus an LLC? No, but if you talk to some attorneys, they razzle dazzle you with the C Corp. You know, they talk about, you know, what an extensive body of law there is in terms of, you know, protecting managers in shareholder lawsuits with the C Corp, and how great Delaware is, you know, in terms of, you know, their laws being favorable to executives and indemnification. And, you know, the reality is the LLC is also an entity, and it's also a corporate shield, right? And it'll suit your needs just fine. In fact, it's a lot more easy to manage, right? The corporate governance responsibilities and requirements are a lot lower than your traditional C Corp. So I said short and sweet, didn't I?
Yeah.
That was like not short and sweet at all. So short and sweet is LLC, small businesses, unless you have, you know, if you expect a huge, you know, capital stake being taken from your company by a, you know, VC firm, venture capital firm, or you're going to go out and solicit a lot of investors still. I mean, they like to see the traditional Inc. or the C Corp structure, right? But if you're not anticipating that, you know, the LLC is just fine. Just throw that out there. You don't even need to consult with us.
Right. A lot of also LLC could be used for your investment properties as well. If you have a multi-unit housing that you keep as investment, you could keep every single one as a separate LLC and then manage it as a separate company. The reason you do that is a lot easier to fold as smaller entities. Let's say when it fails and something happens, whatever, you have to close down, then you could fold that instead of closing the entire company that now manages 20 different properties, and then have it related so that, you know, one liability from one property will transfer over to the other. So it's a good idea if you have a lot of investment properties, keep it as separate LLCs.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, actually. So, I mean, you heard about that term single asset LLCs. Please don't make single asset C Corps. No. That would be really difficult to manage and maintain. And I guarantee you, you're gonna run into some issues with corporate governance. So that actually rolls into the next one.
Subject.
Ta-da.
It's a corporate, no, you went too far. Corporate formalities, shmalities.
So, I mean, reason number five, it kind of tracks along with reason number six that you're going to have to see us in the future is, let's say, for example, you gathered an investment group. And then you formed an entity, you know, let's say through LegalZoom. And, you know, as so many people do nowadays, it's easy, pay some money, boom, they get it all done for you. sort of, right? Because then what happens after you form the entity from LegalZoom is you just forget about it. Like, all right, I did that, check the box, put it aside, and never have to worry about that again. And you may even have one of those fancy corporate kits, but nothing's filled out inside, right? Because there's things that still need to be completed. Bylaws, if you have a C Corp, you have shares that should be issued. You should have a stock register. You know, if you have a C Corp too, you have other corporate governance issues. You got to have your annual directors meetings, shareholder meetings, right? All big decisions, you probably should come together for some kind of meeting of directors or shareholder meetings. And you should actually have some kind of, not verbatim transcript, but, you know, they call them minutes. It should be duly authorized, approved. It should be in your corporate kit. See what I'm getting at? What I'm trying to tell you is that that entity you created, you need to kind of manage it. You got to pretend like it's actually a living, breathing thing, right? Like I like to say, it's like an imaginary friend, right? You got to treat it like an imaginary friend. Someday down the line, you're going to have to prove that that imaginary friend exists. How are you going to prove that it exists? Obviously, it doesn't walk or talk, can't do cartwheels, can't run around like my son. You're going to have to show the paper trail, right? You're going to have to show the corporate kit, the bylaws. You're going to have to show that you had minutes. You're going to have to show all the paperwork. You're going to have to show that you actually treated this entity as a separate entity. Otherwise, the courts are not going to recognize that entity, right? I mean, on the litigation side, right. You know that. I mean, what happens?
It's the primary reason for you having another entity is to put a shield, basically, between yourself, your personal assets, as to your company or corporate asset. Meaning that if somebody, just in case somebody sues your company, that they can't reach into your own pocket as a personal liability, your house, your car, your other assets that you hold personally. And that's why you have a separate entity so that whatever is within contained within the corporate entity is only subject to liability that was incurred by the corporate. Now, if you don't keep up with the corporate formalities such as minute book, directors meeting, and other things that you have to do annually, then there's something called piercing the corporate veil. That corporate veil that we're discussing, it disappears, which means that the other side, person who sues you, could reach into your own personal pocket, try to get your money that you hold personally, or your house. You know, a lot of times, first thing, you know, they'll go after is the fact that you never had a corporate meeting, you never had a corporate minutes filled out, you don't have a stock certificate filled out. A primary thing that they also go after is that you mingle, co-mingle with your fund, through your personal fund with corporate fund. You have corporate account, you got to keep that separately from your personal account. Don't mix those together. If you need to pay yourself from corporate account, you need to do that from corporate account to your personal account so that shows transfers. You know, but if you put in, you try to buy something and you use this corporate card and corporate account to try to buy something for you personally, then, you know, it's one of the proof that to show that you are actually commingling and using this corporation as basically a facade to protect your personal liability. And that could be pierced when you get sued.
Yeah, please don't commingle. That's like one of the biggest things that, especially in, you know, like the minority community, people have a corporate account and then they're just writing checks for me like, Toys R Us, Sally's, rent. Yeah, Sally's daycare expenses, whatever, from the corporate account. Well, that's a paper trail, right? So later on, if, you know, you're getting sued and the plaintiff side, you're going to request in discovery, all right, let me look at all the documents relating to that corporation. They're going to see all of these things. Okay, I guess you've been commingling. That's going to be a big sword that they're going to have to potentially pierce that veil, or to basically strike your corporate entity and strike your shield. And that would just basically mean your personal assets are endangered, and obviously that's not what you want. It's not what you created the corporation for. So, you know, basically the bottom line is remember that you still have to manage your entity, whatever it is, LP, LLC, C Corp, whatever you got. You got to remember to manage it. It's got to be on your mind. It's something you got to do, right? I mean, one thing that just comes to mind right now, you know, one time in my old firm, I used to work for Alston Byrne. So, you know, it's a really large firm. And we were trying to court this client, right? This client was basically in a, on kind of on the tipping point, about to fall into shareholder lawsuit, because amongst other things, he was commingling his funds. But so, you know, we were pitching him this idea, like what he needed to do, and obviously we're pitching, you know, our fees and whatnot. He decided to go somewhere else. He ended up going to Latham Watkins. And the reason I know is because later on he actually told me, we ran into each other and he told me what his fees were. So Latham Watkins were retained simply to paper his book. So for all of these years, he didn't manage his corporate existence. He didn't manage his corporate entity at all. So he had a C Corp, right? It was an Inc. And for like 5-6 years, nothing was done. So Latham Watkins went back in and then started to create a paper trail, right? They're filling it in, filling his corporate kit. Probably it was like 5-6 months after the representation started, he told me they were billing him out. Their average rate was about $250,000 a month to fill out his corporate kit. Of course, that was a larger company, probably 1,000 investors, but he had to do that because otherwise, when he walked into that shareholder lawsuit, he'd walk in completely exposed. This guy had like 13 children too, so his personal assets were something he really wanted to keep safe. So, I mean, if that doesn't tell you how bad it could be later on, I mean, I don't know what will.
I think that another point you brought up, the shareholder lawsuit thing, is that when you take money from other people as investment, and then let's say you try, you know, it's called your best effort. You use best effort to make profit and turn their investment into a larger amount of money, but you fail, and then they think that you somehow use that money personally, and you know, you somehow did something personally so that it costs a failure. First thing they'll attack is the fact that you did not maintain a corporate account, you did not maintain a corporate formalities, and that's, you know, like I said, that pretty much a presumption that, you know, when the court looks at it, that you commingled and then you actually siphoned money out of the account, even if you didn't, there is a presumption that you did that because you did not maintain the corporate formalities.
All right, next up.
Number three is a, come on, that guy drives a BMW.
Number four,
I'm sorry.
I know you want this to be over. So, I mean, basically what this means right here is the number four reason why you're going to have to see us in the future is because you decided to sue somebody with another attorney. Shame on you. And before you started the litigation and you went all in through discovery and all of these time-consuming and not to mention pocketbook taxing endeavors, the attorney didn't tell you to, and you didn't, do an asset search on the defendant to ensure that that person had assets to actually go after, right, before you sued them. Because what's the point of suing somebody, right? You're trying to perhaps receive compensation. Most of the time, it's about the money. Even when people say it's about principle, it ends up being about the money somehow, right? It's
of course, always.
Strangest thing. But if the person doesn't have money to begin with, or that person potentially is insolvent, then you're wasting your time and your money, right? And this happens all the time, right? So people will come to us and they'll say, you know what, my attorney doesn't do this. Can you represent us in the bankruptcy proceeding? We need to do a creditor rights claim against, because the defendant in the case who we were suing filed bankruptcy. If you didn't know, bankruptcy is a tremendously large sword against not just debts, right, but also potential judgments. So even if you sued somebody and you got a judgment, let's say someone breached a business contract, you got a judgment for $1 million. Let's say that company files bankruptcy, that bankruptcy goes through and gets a discharge. Guess what happens to that judgment? Chopped. It's gone. So, you know, there's only certain types of things that are not discharged in bankruptcy, like, you know, a judgment stemming from fraud. You know, if you receive some kind of reward from a personal injury claim, and obviously the big one, I think many of us know, student loans, right? You can't discharge student loans. I mean, otherwise, I know I'd file BK. But, you know, because BK is always there, potentially there, you got to know who you're going after. You got to do that asset search, right? And for people who don't do the asset search, or for the attorneys that don't, you know, suggest that to you at the outset, they're doing you a disservice, right? Because you may be chasing nothing. You may be chasing nothing. Throwing good money at bad money is what we like to say.
Right. The reason I have the title is that, come on, that guy has BMW, is that just because he drives a nice car, he lives in a nice house, it seems like he has money, doesn't mean he really has money that you could go after. You know, the car could be on the lease, money, house could be on a rental house, you know, he's paying monthly from, you know, whatever.
And it's being foreclosed.
Yeah, many times in, you know, this economic downturn, we've, you know, seen people who had a lot of properties and money obviously go into foreclosure and other things. So, and another important point of this is that before you get into business with someone, before you buy into someone's idea, you know, it's probably a good idea to make sure that guy has, you know, enough capital, enough assets to actually make this business happen. You know, so that later on, you don't have to look back and say, I should have done this, you should have done that. Like I said, I have so many clients who tells me, I'm going to sue this guy, get a $100,000 judgment on principle because I don't care how much it costs. You could charge me whatever you want, and, you know, I just want a judgment against him. You know, and then at the end of the day, when he gets the judgment, I tell him he seems like he has no asset, whatever, whatever, whatever. You know, and then I get a judgment for him, and then he or she oftentimes is not happy because they can't collect on it. You know, that's why it's important to do an asset search. And asset search nowadays is so thorough. They have information that you would not believe. They have information on their entire family member, extended family member, transfer record between the, you know, families. You know, because a lot of people try to hide their assets, right, before they think they're going to get sued. It's called fraudulent conveyance. If you, before 1 year or after 1 year of the time of the lawsuit, if you transfer any property to someone else, it's actually deemed as fraudulent conveyance because you try to basically hide your assets. And that all those assets, if you prove that wasn't a legitimate bona fide purchase or sale, then you could bring those property back into his or her own asset and go after it to collect. You know, so that it's important that you ask for an asset search to be done before you go after someone.
We know because we do that all the time, right? We go after people who try to convey their properties in anticipation of litigation. It's very common. You know, and on the other thing, you know, in terms of asset picture, people are always wondering, well, what information can I really get? His home is in his mom's name. Right, you can actually look into people's bank accounts, see how much money they have, how liquid they are. You can find out where they work, if they're W-2, right? Because you can do wage garnishments. So, I mean, don't underestimate that. And it's not cost prohibitive. I mean, it's going to cost a little bit of money to do those searches, but...
A couple hundred to a thorough one, 1,000. But thorough one, it's 50 states, all asset, all account. And oftentimes, you don't need that. You need California. You know, you need local whatever search, you know, when you know this person is not, you know, nationally doing something, then, you know, it's a couple hundred dollars at most.
Yeah, and if you're thinking about suing someone, you know, you're already about to undertake a pretty expensive endeavor. You might as well spend a little bit of money to make sure it's worth it, right? Because that would be the worst case scenario, is to spend all that money and then have it turn out to be absolutely for nothing. Next up.
Next one. Okay, number three, the ostrich defense. Do you guys know what ostrich is? It's a large bird.
It's a mammal?
Yeah,
no, I'm just kidding.
It's not a mammal. It's a bird.
I mean, basically, what we're trying to say here is that a lot of people end up having to see us, and hopefully none of you are going to fall into that category, is because they think that only the laws they know of are the ones that actually pertain to their business, right? So it's the ostrich defense, right? What ostriches do? They stick their head in the ground when they sense danger because they think, hey, if I can't see it, it can't see me. It being whatever, I don't know. And it's Australia, right?
Yeah, it's actually, this is a term that's used in the legal field a lot.
Cheetahs or something?
Yeah, it's not something that we made up. It's actually used a lot because, you know, a lot of times people claim that, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know I have to get that permit. I didn't know that I have to, you know, pay this. I didn't know this. I didn't know that. But not knowing the law is not a defense, you know? So that's what the ostrich defense is.
I mean, California definitely holds employers you know, amongst other categories of people like landlords, right? They really hold your feet to the flames. They charge you with knowing the regulations that pertain to your business. And if you don't know them, it's too bad, right? They'll fine you willy-nilly. Did Jimmy leave already? I mean, it's because they just expect you to know, right? If you don't know, that's not good enough. So, I mean, obviously there's resources for you to know about the different aspects of your business. EDD obviously puts on classes and whatnot. When it comes to the labor code, you know, the Department of Industrial Relations, they have a pretty almost too thorough website. It has too much information there. But also, you know, obviously attorneys are a resource potentially for setting things up on the business end. But there's another thing that people run into all the time, and they come to us or they come to other attorneys, and attorneys, like, they're special magic, right? So they say, oh, you know what? I'm going to start this business. Like, let's say I'm going to start a car wash. What do I need to do, right? That's a really typical question. So the attorney goes, well, you know what? I don't really know right now. I'll get right back to you. 5 minutes later, he's like, well, you need this permit. You need that permit. You know, you need to get a certificate of operations from the Southern California Air Quality Management District and all of these things. And the guy's like, wow, like, how'd you know that, right? And a lot of attorneys like, well, you know, it's my experience and my wisdom. I graduated Harvard cum laude. Actually, in California, there's a really good resource for that, calgold.ca.gov, right? That website, attorneys have been using that for years. And I don't know how that's escaped a lot of business people, you know, entrepreneurs. That CalGold website is really, really helpful when you're starting any type of business, right? You go to CalGold website, ca.gov, and it has a list of different types of businesses, you know, and you basically type in what your business is, right, and then the location of your business, and it just generates this whole list of permits you're going to need to get, you know, whether it's a seller's permit or a, you know, business permit in this city or that city. It tells you all the different certificates and clearances you may need to, in order to start running your business pertaining to the regulations, right? So, you know, I mean, as we always say in a very candid fashion, I mean, attorneys don't know everything. Any attorney who says they do is
lying.
It's probably drunk. Yeah. Drunk, like I said before, there's a lot of drinking in that community. But what attorneys are trained to do, though, is they're trained to find the answers, right? So if anything else, they're trained to research, right? So they could research the answers. But this is a huge research tool that allow you to do the same type of research without attorneys, right? I mean, I know we're really funny, and you, I know you like to talk to us, but, you know, you don't want to always have to call us, right? Because most of the time you call an attorney, and guess what? That's 0.2 hours billed to you.
All right. Next one.
CalGold.
Yeah. I read the contract.
So, number two reason why you're going to have to come see us is that you believe that, hey, if I understand 50% of this contract, I'm good to go. I'm ready to sign my life away. It's like when you sign up for the military, you know, they have all these contracts and you're like, oh, sounds good, sign it. And next thing you know, you're like, wait a second, you didn't tell me I was going to have to do this. Basically, the question here is like, how much of the contracts that you enter into do you really understand? Right? Because the material terms, the other side's going to make sure you understand the material terms, right? What are you entering into? How much? When are you going to pay? When is it going to be delivered? But the devil's in the details, right? The devil's in the details. And the details burns a whole bunch of people all the time. We see this happen all the time, right? And then they tell us, hey, you know what? I didn't know this was in there. We look at the contract and, you know what? You signed this contract. You're signed. You're charged now with knowing, I mean, that you read the contract, you understood it, and that you were going to be responsible for fulfilling the terms of the contract. The bottom line is, it pays to know, right? It pays to know some things. But it doesn't always mean that you got to talk to an attorney. Do you always have to go to an attorney to figure out what certain provisions are? No. Because the smartest, I don't know if it's a person, I call him Mr. though. Mr. Google. Mr. Google is always out there. And, you know, Mr. Google provides a lot of answers to these types of questions. So don't go into a contract, I would say, in the future, leaving a provision misunderstood or leaving a provision open where you don't understand really what it means. Like, what is this? Oh, whatever. It doesn't matter. I'm sure everything will work out just fine. That's a really dangerous and cavalier attitude to have about your contract.
We'll go over a few provisions that oftentimes pops up in business contract or business purchase contract. The first thing is liquidated damages provision. Does anybody know what liquidated damages provision is? Okay. And it has nothing to do with the liquid. No water.
It's
no
not
rain.
A DUI. No, liquidated it's damages.
It's not. Liquidated damages provision is a provision that, because it's hard to ascertain the actual damage of whatever one of the breach occurred, so in advance you agree to pay the other person or the other party agrees to pay you some of money. You know, it's a set amount, you know, when there is a breach. And typically this one is in a real estate contract. If you agree to buy a house and you just had a change of mind, right, and you put a deposit on a money deposit and you pulled out, there is a liquidated damage provision that, you know, in a car form always says that you will forfeit your deposit as liquidated damages, because it's hard to ascertain what the seller's damages are when you pulled out. So you lose your deposit. And this liquidated damages provision are in a lot of different business contracts as well. Because the seller or buyer canceled the contract, you agreed to pay certain sums of money, even if, and the thing is that you don't, the seller or buyer, the person who suffered a breach, doesn't have to prove that he or she actually lost an amount. Even if there was no loss, you're agreeing to pay that amount. And oftentimes people overlook the liquidated damages provision and sign the contract. And you'll be liable to pay that sum of money that you agreed to pay.
I'm gonna read an example of one, but I'm starting to think that I shouldn't. It's really long and...
Yeah.
Well, I'll paraphrase it. Because this is a real provision from a real contract. So it's like, in the event that X does not fulfill the initial 3-year term, then X shall pay liquidated damages to Y in the amount of $50,000 without waiving any of Y's other rights or remedies, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, really what that's saying to you is that this amount of damages, the other party is not going to have to prove. They're not going to have to prove that these damages are reasonable or compensates them for any specific thing. Right? Because you've already agreed. These are liquidated damages. These damages are just contracted for. Right? So you got to be careful. If there's a liquidated damages provision in your contracts, you got to be careful you understand what that is and what triggers that, most importantly.
All right. The next one is the integration clause. Does anybody know what integration clause is? Okay.
Sounds like a law school class right now.
Integration.
You right there.
Integration clause is basically, it means that is whatever you agreed within the document is the entire contract. Now, for example, oftentimes nowadays when you try to lease premises, you know, for your business, whatever your residence, they give you free rent, right? They lure you with free rent. I'm not saying this happens all the time, but they do lure you with free rent, and then you say, I have two free rent, I'm going to offer you, landlord says. I said, okay, but let's just say that free rent provision wasn't in the lease contract and you signed the lease, you know, and then there's the integration clause, which states that this is the entire contract and nothing else was agreed upon. You know, that orally agreed upon portion of the free rent is not going to be enforceable. You know, so you can't go and claim, say, oh, you also told me there was a free rent. No, because there was an integration clause, you know, and then you forgot to check, make sure whatever you already agreed upon was also in the contract, you know, it's no longer enforceable.
Yeah, sometimes it's just titled entire agreement in the contract itself. It just means that, hey, the four corners of the document, that's our entire agreement. So anything else I'm going to tell you on the side, orally or whatnot, that doesn't really apply, right? So you got to be careful about the integration clause if the person is making oral promises. Demand that in writing, right? That's something that we also always tell people, right? Make it a habit. Get everything in writing. Email something, right? Email is better than nothing, All right, get it in writing. Someone's going to make a promise, get it in writing. If you already have a contract, ask them to modify it. Right? It's annoying, yes, but it protects you. So you have a right to be annoying.
All right. Next provision is indemnification. Does anybody know what indemnification is? Okay. Indemnification means that it's also known as a hold harmless clause. It's usually used by a subcontractor or a primary contractor for a subcontractor, meaning that you hire an independent contractor to do this portion of work. Let's say you're building a building and you hire someone to do concrete. And you know, you as a prime contractor didn't do the concrete itself, but concrete later on proven to be defectively, you know, built or poured, whatever, and there was a problem. Now you are liable to the landlord or the property owner as a general contractor for picking out the subcontractor who actually had a defective work performed. Now, if you didn't have the indemnification clause, okay, then it might, you might not be able to go after the subcontractor. And also, subcontractors, what it is, if you did have an indemnification clause, that means that subcontractors guaranteeing that if there's a problem, and then even if general contractor didn't sue directly, if say, let's say the property owner sued general contractor, then automatically it triggers liability of the subcontractor, and subcontractor will be liable for that portion of whatever work was performed. And it's also integral that you make sure when you enter into that kind of contract, there is an insurance policy, you know, on the other side, subcontractor. If you're giving someone work, and then that work might potentially have some kind of a defect that could cause harm, then you need to make sure that the person has an insurance policy to cover such defect, and have you make sure that you have an identification that insurance is going to cover you as well, not your own insurance, but the subcontractor's insurance as well.
So they also call that hold harmless provision. Right? Right. So indemnify means hold harmless. So if you're going to hold someone else harmless for some liabilities, you should know what you're getting into, right? So the last one, I'm just going to bring this up, reps and warranties, right? So there's a section always in contracts, it's representations and warranties, whether it's buyer's representation, distributor's representation, X's representations. And a lot of people just, I don't know why, they just gloss right over it, right? Because a lot of it is like factual statements, right? It says like, buyer agrees and acknowledges that they are authorized to execute and enter into this agreement. So after they read the first couple ones, they're like, yeah, it's all right. It's all just facts. Right? The problem is that is probably one of the most dangerous provisions in your contract, right? Because basically, the California Civil Code, it prevents in a contract cause of action, right? So if someone sues you because you violated a business contract, right? You breached a contract. The civil code prevents them from suing you for punitive damages, right? So you can obviously get compensatory damages to compensate you for your loss. But punitive damages are damages that is awarded to you just to punish the wrongdoer, right? For taking some kind of wrongful action, right? Like fraud or whatnot. In purely contract actions, the civil code prevents a plaintiff from seeking punitive damages. Now, in your representations and warranties, if you make a material misrepresentation in your representation and warranty section, now the plaintiffs potentially can add to their causes of action a cause of action for fraud, right? Whether it's fraud in the inducement or what have you.
Concealment.
Now what that's going to do is they brought fraud in. Fraud is a tort. That opens you up to punitive damages. And those punitive damages are really hard to determine what they're going to be, right? They can be way more than the compensatory damages,
right?
It could be scary how much punitive damages are. Sometimes they're not so much, but just if we're trying to once again mitigate our liabilities, we want to prevent that from happening, right? So we want to make sure our reps and warranties sections are accurate, truthful, and not misleading. Bottom line.
Yeah, those punitive damages you often see in class action. And when you see a large sum of award for class action lawsuits, the majority portion of that judgment or award is actually from punitive damages. Compensatory damages could be $100,000, and punitive is in $1 million. You know, that's very possible.
All right, now we're up to the tip of the mountain.
Last slide.
tip of the mouth.
And you hired this guy. And where's Francis?
You pointed at me, did you? You hired this guy? No, not me.
Can you turn the lights down right here? Oh. Thank you.
Here's a quick summary. Our production value is not as high as we would like. All
right. Huh. What happened to the video?
Oh, hey, it's okay.
This is my favorite attorney. I might have went to the same law school as that guy, so it's not that funny to me.
His whole point of this video is not when you're trying to show an attorney who is bad at his job. The whole point of the video is you selecting people who are not qualified to do certain tasks. And especially in, I know what happens, I work with a lot of different minority communities, not just Asian people, but Hispanics as well. And there's certain individual who pretends to know the law, pretends to know certain things and have an expertise, like, you know, in Spanish they call notarios, you know, and they're not attorneys, you know, but they actually do a lot of legal work, you know, and they have other services. You know, if you go around K-Town where I work, and they have offices that are an attorney's office, but it says legal service, you know, and they claim to have an expertise in immigration and other things. And the truth of the matter is that when something goes wrong, because they make you do everything in your own name, suing someone, you know, it's called pro per, you know, and they're not being responsible for their job. They're still telling you, pretending that you're doing it, but I'll help you do it. But oftentimes they provide you with incorrect information, okay, and they're not going to be responsible. For example, I had this client who brought in a $200,000 judgment, and she consulted with this one of these notarios. And I asked her, how did you get the judgment? She said, oh, he just got it. You know, I said, did you serve the defendants? I don't know. You know, have you ever been to court? No. You know, but you have a court judgment for $200,000. What that person did was, you know, that person promised my client he was going to get a $200,000 judgment without going to court, and which he did. But what he forgot to tell her is that he never served the defendant. He lied to the court. He doctored up the proof of service, the service documents stating that they properly served the defendant, and then, you know, made it seem like the defendant ignored the lawsuit, and then he got a default judgment. Now, that judgment, when you try to collect against the defendant is going to challenge that judgment. Not only the defendant will challenge that judgment, but court will find you contempt in court for not properly serving the defendant and obtaining fraudulent judgment, and you'll be fined, and you could actually have a jail term too if you do that. And everything went under your name. Because obviously that person wasn't an attorney, so he couldn't fill out his name. So he made you sign everything in your own name. And you filed it like you were bringing your own lawsuit. You know, but ended up that we actually had to agree to dismiss the judgment. And then she, at the time, you know, you have something called statute of limitations. You have within certain time, you have to bring your claim. Statute of limitation expired. She lost her claim forever. And then, you know, and there was a fake judgment.
You get what you pay for, right?
True.
And that, the legal field is no exception, right? So once something is messed up and you bring it back to us, it's going to cost us so much more money to fix it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it kind of, it will pay off on average in the long run, right? If you seek the advice and counsel of professionals, right? Licensed people, nothing else. Their license stands as some kind of leverage over their heads to ensure that the information they're giving you is accurate, right? You ask non-attorneys and they suggest to you a course of action. What happens if they're wrong? Nothing, all right? There's nothing gonna happen to them. So the license is really important in terms of dealing with somebody in any industry. In the legal industry, we just wanna share with you, is no exception, right?
Okay.
All right, we're gonna move into some questions. Apparently, we got some cards. I'm gonna read the questions out loud, if you don't mind. Looks like the same person wrote both questions. Highly suspicious.
She did.
Any other questions?
All right. So the first one is, it says, how do I know if the business structure I chose or I choose is best for me? Well, I guess if someone sues you and you lose, it's probably the wrong one if you get the shield pierced. What do you have to say?
Right. No, you should talk to us. You should talk to an attorney. You should talk to a CPA. Each type of, different type of business require a different type of structure, you know, and you should talk to an, and, you know, believe it or not, it doesn't cost that much money just to talk. And we don't usually charge for, you know, basic consultation. If you just need simple information, approach someone who has expertise, who could offer you, you know, information at low cost, and they'll pay dividends. You know, and this question can't be answered very easily because I don't know what type. Like I said, if you own a single purpose property, you know, investment property, put it in an LLC. That's what I tell you. This is easy. You know, and different. If you are doing venture capital and inviting thousands of people to invest, do a C corp. You know, so each circumstance.
Yeah, it's really hard to answer generally. I mean, what did you say? I mean, I would say small business LLC.
Yeah.
Business that you anticipate getting VC funding, get a C corp. You're gonna have thousands of investors, even 100 investors, do a C corp in Delaware, right? But it all depends, right?
Right.
So, you know, in the end of the day, it's fact dependent. So the second question is, how do small business owners work with lawyers like you? And then, do we have to keep you on retainer, or is a single project okay? So, I mean, I guess I want to say something. I think we should bring this up. So, you know, one thing that our firm, and when we started, we really believed that, you know, the legal model was broken. We all come from big firms, and, you know, we come from multiple firms, some of us. And, you know, I've worked government side, I've worked on the plaintiff side, I worked at a mid-sized firm, I worked for Am Law 20 firm, and now, you know, we started our own firm with the premise that, you know what, lawyers too much are seen and act like deal killers, right? A lot of times they're the impediment to moving forward because they just tell you all of these issues, like, oh, look at this liability, look at this one, this one, this one, this one, and they don't pose solutions necessarily, right? Because when they pose a solution, that's a risk for them if it's wrong. So that many times is not helpful, right? It just muddies the water in front of you. What we wanted to be was, we wanted to be, number one, cost effective, but we wanted to be a resource for deals to actually move forward, right? We want to be an asset to businesses, not a detriment. We're not the people that are gonna spook you every step of the way, you know, in terms of scaring you, in terms of all the risks. Here's the risk here, here's the risk here, here's the risk here. That doesn't help businesses. And we've done that too much. Lawyers have done that too much, right? And lawyers have billed too much, right, in terms of just talking with the little, you know, little mom and pop stores. That's why in a lot of ways, when the economic downturn, the real estate bubble burst, we saw at my big firm, I saw how many people were left in the dust with no legal representation. We're talking from mid-level down to small businesses, right? Because they just no longer can afford $50,000 retainers, right? So in answer to this question, our answer is that Venerable, we're flexible, right? We work with you because, like I said, we made this firm to be an asset, right? Asset to businesses, an asset to our community, really, right? If I wanted to make money, I would have stayed in my firm, right? I do not make as much money as I did back then, right? There's a reason, because I want to make the practice of law fulfilling, right? The practice of law can be really, really dry and harsh. Lawyers had one of the highest depression rates amongst all the industries, right? I think dentists took the most. Dentist, I don't know yes. why. I guess if you look in someone's mouth long enough, you'll be depressed too. But the lawyers, they're not satisfied because in the end of the day, when you look at, you know, people who are representing, I used to represent BP, Wells Fargo, B of A, right? And you're just like, wow, what am I doing every day? I'm just a cog. I'm a cog that no one even knows is there. You know, we're just doing these things. It's too big of a giant, right? You can never help the little people because they're priced out, right? So they don't get quality legal representation because all of these firms are basically putting golden handcuffs on all the talent, on the legal talent, right? So we were like, okay, that's enough. That's enough of that, right? We want to really bring our services to bear to help our family members, our friends, and other people in the community, right? Small businesses, individuals. So what I'll say in answer to that question, like I said, we're flexible, right? If you have a question that I can answer on the phone, I will answer it. You call me, I will answer your question. No retainer, no fee. I'm not going to charge you anything. You want to consult with me on an issue, on a serious issue? Just come in, make an appointment, I'll talk with you. If you can't pay the fee, there is no fee then, right? Because we want to be an asset. This is not a business necessarily, I mean, a profit-making venture solely, right? There's other reasons why we created Venerable. And there's other reasons why we're part of the ABA. And those reasons also, some of the reasons why we're giving this presentation today, right? Because we want to be able to share with you things that don't cost you money.
Yeah, we're very personable too, and easy to approach. Trust me, I deal with the most basic problems and questions that businesses have. We don't always have sophisticated questions and how to structure finance deals and stuff like that. If you have any kind of simple question, you know, I have questions like, okay, I just got a notice for 3-day notice from my landlord. I can answer that, you know. So just let us know. And we have another question that just came in.
Is the last question.
Yeah, last question. Do we need to put our own house under LLC and why? You don't need to put your own house in LLC unless it's an investment property, unless it's generating income. Because the purpose of creating an LLC corporation and all that is to generate income so that, you know, it's a profit-making company. If you're living in your own house, you know.
Yeah, people have asked that question a lot. And I'll say, you know, your lender's generally not going to like that,
yeah,
right?
Of course.
Because your lender's got to approve the substitution of the borrower or the,
exactly.
You know, substitution of the named title owner of the property. And they're not going to like the LLC idea.
Right.
So basically, bottom line, you have our small business guide, our cards in there. Have any questions, give us a call. Feel free to visit us also on www.venerablelaw.com. And we appreciate you joining us on our first live podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sydney and Alex. And on behalf of the Asian Business Association, we'd like to present you with these tokens of our appreciation. So for
thank you.
Sydney and for Alex,
that is my name in Chinese.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. So.